Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Gerald Horn. He is the John Jay and Rebecca Moores Professor of African American History at the University of Houston. And we're talking about his book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. Gerald, welcome to the show. This is a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Now, this is a mammoth book. It literally goes through the decades. What attracted you? Now, you're a major African-American historian at the University of Houston. Why did you pick jazz as the focus of a book?
Well, for many different reasons. First of all, I'm from a musical family. I grew up in a house in St. Louis where there was always a guitar around. And my father used to pluck it from time to time. My brother is a professional guitarist as a direct result. And my older brother would always play this music, which attracted me from an early age. And then second of all, I thought it would be a window into discovering black culture and the struggles of black people, which I think that turned out to be the case.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is, like I said, there's a mammoth amount of research in this book. Was this a book that took you years to put together?
In a sense, but, you know, I travel a lot and to do research. I was at the Earl Garner Papers in Pittsburgh, the Sonny Rollins Papers in New York, the Max Roach and Charles Mingus Papers in D.C., the Lionel Hampton Papers way out in Idaho, the Dave Brubeck Papers at the University of the Pacific in California. But I was traveling all the time, so despite all of the research, it didn't take as long as you might imagine.
I want your job. That sounds like
I see.
Now let's talk about the origins of jazz. Where do you think that there's a specific geographical place that we can pin and say, yeah, jazz started here?
Well, if I were speaking to you and you were in New Orleans, I would say New Orleans. People in New Orleans get very upset if you do not say this music was born in New Orleans. And I think that that's a credible explanation for the origins of this music. But at the same time, I think there is suggestive evidence that the Mississippi River Basin, that is to say, not only New Orleans, but Memphis, St. Louis, et cetera, could be seen as a birthplace for this music, not to mention the fact that there were simultaneous musical developments taking place on the West Coast, even though this was at a time, I'm talking about the first decade of the 20th century,
right,
where there are not that many people of African origin on the West Coast. And of course, as you know, this music is of African origin. One can trace its roots to certain parts of Africa. Certainly the blues is the essence of this music we call jazz, which, as you know, is based not only upon a technical mastery of certain instruments, such as piano, strings, horns, percussion, etc., but also oftentimes involves improvisation.
Now, it seems, according to your book, that from the very beginning, jazz was considered subversive by white society. Would you say that's true?
I think that's a fair assessment. I mean, after all, there was an anti-jazz movement that sought to outlaw this music, which was seen as too suggestive. It was seen, the rhythm was seen as...
perhaps, it was seen as black.
Well, that's true, too. It was seen as black. And, of course, there's a continuing controversy about, believe it or not, about that idea that this is a music that comes out of black people. And, in fact, one of the points that I make about the musical turn that we know as bebop, which arises generally in the 1940s, it arises for many different reasons, but amongst those reasons is that in the hothouse of this music that was Manhattan, and particularly Harlem, uptown, and the Village downtown, there was objection to the swing of this music and that it was supposedly encouraging dancing, heterosexual dancing across the color line.
Whoops.
And there were certain forces that took objection to that. And then, therefore, you have this transition from a dancing music to a listening music. And not to mention the fact that many musicians were really trying to make a more complex music for various reasons. But one of the reasons was that they thought that their art was being pilfered. and they thought that if they made the music more complex, it would be more difficult to pilfer, although I think that they proved to be mistaken.
It's fascinating to me about that relationship about bebop. One of the quotes in your book is, it was considered no more than a narcotic. It's interesting because that was happening about early rock and roll at the same time period. There were color concerns about race mixing, about people dancing, about it, people expressing themselves. But jazz took a totally different turn in response to that, and that was bebop. And I love the fact that you wrote about that jazz artists were being copied from the very beginning and written out of the history of jazz, black artists. Turn to this much, for me, what my favorite form of jazz is the much more abstract jazz of the post-war period. And even then, they got copied.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's very difficult to come up with an art form that is not subject to being emulated. I mean, even, as a matter of fact, one could even make an argument that perhaps it might easier to emulate if it's more complicated and complex. I mean, look at abstract painting, for example. That's the kind of painting that it might be easiest to emulate of all.
Now, you write in your book, even by the 1930s, there was a concerted effort to downplay black Americans' role in originating jazz, literally from the beginning of jazz, an attempt to rewrite the role of African Americans, jazz as a whole. What form did that take?
Well, it's very interesting. I'm sure you know about the trope of Paul Whiteman.
Oh yeah,
the king of jazz.
Well, there's an appropriate name.
Yeah, I guess so. You're not the first person to point that out.
I'm sure I'm not.
And also, part of the problem, I'm afraid to say, and this is probably getting me into trouble, part of the problem are the critics. There's a whole critique of the critics in this book, with the critique oftentimes articulated by the musicians themselves, who wonder what are the credentials of these critics. Indeed, I quote the offspring of one of the critics criticizing her father for writing jazz criticism when she says he doesn't know anything about music. But then that bleeds into this concept that some of the critics call Crow Jim, which is the flip side of Jim Crow. That is to say, they felt that these critics, who are mostly white, were getting short shrift, that they didn't get enough respect. And that, of course, then leads to a counter-reaction when the critic then known as Leroy Jones then begins to excoriate him. And then there was a white critic by the name of Frank Kofsky, who also excoriates his compatriots in the critic business for what he sees to be their insensitivity in teasing out the racial angles of this music.
Now, there's several themes that run throughout your book, and we'll talk about them throughout the time. But one of them that I always found sort of bittersweet is how many jazz musicians traveled abroad and found themselves so much more greatly appreciated in places like Europe than they were in the United States. And not only that they had to deal with a lot less crap when they were on the stage and working with clubs, that they were appreciated overseas. When did that start, that American jazz musicians traveled to, black American jazz musicians traveled to Europe and found a much more receptive audience there?
Well, I think it's from the beginning of this music, which generally is agreed to have been initiated in the late 19th century, but certainly World War One is a turning point. World War One, of course, you have many black musicians who are conscripted, that is to say, drafted, and they join the U.S. military and then are shipped off to Europe. Speaking of Europe, that leads us to James Europe, yep. This black band leader who created quite a stir with that music, with his music in Western Europe, and then of course Sidney Bechet, who also has New Orleans roots. He spent quite a bit of time in Paris. But you are correct. Over the years, even up to this very day, even my brother, who I just said is a musician, he probably earns as much in a few weeks in Japan than he can make in a whole year in New York, for example. And speaking of Japan, it's not only like Paris, which oftentimes is pointed to, given the role of Miles Davis in Paris.
Yep.
It's not only Copenhagen, given the role of Dexter Gordon in Copenhagen. It's not only Vienna, given the role of Art Farmer in Vienna. It's Japan, where the percussionist Art Blakey, the bassist Ron Carter, all were embraced. As a matter of fact, there are a considerable number of jazz clubs in Tokyo which are supporting many musicians. And I think the irony of all ironies is that the grandson of Booker T. Washington, I'm sure your audience recalls Booker T. Washington, mm-hmm. who was this this grand black leader of the early 20th century, sort of counterpart to Martin Luther King, for example, in his era. His grandson, Booker Pittman, was a jazz musician who wound up in exile in Brazil. So, and then, of course, there are the musicians who wound up in Africa. Yusef Lateef, the horn man, winds up in Nigeria. Randy Weston, the pianist. You know, there's a street about to be named for Randy Weston in Brooklyn. That great 6'8" piano player wound up in Morocco. So there's a jazz diaspora, which is worthy of note.
Some of them come back, though. Like you think about Dexter Gordon. What was his reaction when he returned to America after a long stay? He fell in love with Denmark and he had a great time in Europe. What happens when these jazz musicians return home after a long stay abroad? Are they often disappointed by how they're treated here?
Well, I'm not sure if it's disappointed, but certainly not necessarily pleased, certainly oftentimes dissatisfied, because oftentimes it's like day and night. I mean, as you know, in Western Europe generally, there's much more subsidies.
Yep.
There's much more government support
right.
for the arts. I mean, here, of course, you have a certain amount of subsidy to European classical music, for example, with the Cleveland Orchestra, orchestras in Boston, New York, et cetera. And, of course, now you have jazz at Lincoln Center, which is a move in that direction, but that's generally speaking confined to Manhattan. And so many of these artists oftentimes were dissatisfied, and they were sort of befuddled and baffled and puzzled as to why they could be treated so royally overseas and treated so disdainfully in the place of their birth.
It's and for people who don't know who are listening, and you document this tremendously in this book, some of the things that these artists, these incredible artists, faced while they were on stage in America, which is it's just dispiriting. They were dealing with racial epithets thrown at them all the time, often violence geared to them. It's amazing what they went through.
Well, one prototypical story that I tell in the book takes place in St. Louis in the 1920s. When you had Ku Klux Klan elements who were seeking to exclude black people from the stage and from clubs, and then you had mafia elements who were interested in exploiting them shamelessly. And there was a kind of shootout, a sort of battle with the OK Corral between the Klan and the mafia, with the mafia, of course, coming up on top, and therefore the black musicians won the Pyrrhic right to be exploited shamelessly as opposed to being excluded. And I think that's just one of the terrible stories. And then, of course, they were oftentimes in these smoky clubs. Oftentimes, the so-called fans would harass them. Oftentimes, they had to play in segregated clubs where there'd be a rope down the middle of the hall with blacks on one side and whites on the other. And then that's not even to talk about how oftentimes they were mistreated and maltreated by record labels.
Oh, yeah.
You had one particular record label in particular, which consciously sought to entice and inveigle these musicians into being drug addicts so that they could be paid with drugs and wouldn't ask for that much money, and then would sign adhesion contracts, that is to say, one-sided contracts. And then, of course, there are their own managers who exploited them. I mean, for example, the great Duke Ellington out of Washington, D.C., composer, band leader, a pianist, one of his managers actually affixed his signature, that is to say the manager's signature, onto some of Duke Ellington's key compositions, meaning that even though both Ellington and the manager are now deceased, the descendants of the manager are now reaping the royalties and the benefits of these Duke Ellington compositions. So it's quite a sordid and dastardly tale, although I don't want to be one-sided. Of course, there are many people struggling against that. I single out for praise, for example, Harry Bridges,
who actually
was born in Australia, migrates to California, helps to organize the West Coast Longshore, but organizes many different unions and threatens to organize a counterpart to the musicians' union unless they shaped up with regard to the maltreatment and mistreatment of black musicians. And I mentioned Dave Brubeck, who, of course, was not black, but was celebrated as a pianist and refused to play in segregated locales, which was quite heroic in the 1950s.
In the early days, like the 30s and the 40s, as you write, many musicians felt that they had to carry weapons. Some even learned boxing just so they could defend themselves as musicians, which seems insane.
Well, yes, there is a sort of equivalence, if you'd like, between the skills that go into certain kinds of instruments and the skills that go into boxing. For example, quick reflexes. For example, supple fingers.
Yep,
for example, Miles Davis,
yep.
For example, was notorious as a boxer. Stan Levy, who was a leading a bebop drummer, was also a boxer. And there are other examples as well of boxer musicians and musician boxers. And, of course, being handy with the fists oftentimes came in handy. When you had to confront racist, quote, fans, unquote, or obstreperous club owners, or whatever the case.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Gerald Horn. He is the John Jay and Rebecca Morris Professor of African American History at the University of Houston. And we're talking about his incredible history, Jazz and Justice, Racism and Political Economy of the Music. You brought up the effects of organized crime throughout the history of jazz, and it's amazing. Until you read your book, I don't think people have any idea how closely knit the fortunes of jazz musicians were to organized crime. Can you talk about that? When did that start for the jazz musicians?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it was present from the inception because, as you know, part of the story of this music, insofar as New Orleans is seen as the cradle, is that this music, to a certain extent, is born in the bordello culture of New Orleans, which was quite infamous and quite notorious for quite a long while. And in fact, there's a story about how when there's a crackdown on the bordello culture in New Orleans around the time of World War I, that leads to one of the first diasporas of jazz, with many of the musicians moving on. Although some of that story I question to a certain extent, because if they moved on, it would be easier just to go straight up the Mississippi River to Memphis or St. Louis. And then, of course, some historians try to argue they wound up in Kansas City, which is actually 230 miles west of the Mississippi River. But in any case, in Kansas City, it was really a hotbed of this music in the 1920s and 1930s. The jazz clubs were oftentimes administered and owned by organized crime types who had influence in the politics, the political machines of Kansas City. And then in Chicago, the Capone crime family oftentimes sponsored these clubs. In fact, Al Capone, by some, is considered the Medici, sort of the Pope, if you like, or the key sponsor of this music in the 1920s and the 1930s. And keep in mind that also these organized crime elements had a foothold in terms of not only clubs, but jukeboxes, because you know, they tend to like businesses that generate cash, because then it becomes easier to launder money when you make your deposits into banks. And of course, jukeboxes, they're basically just, it's a coin business for the most part. And then consider the takeoff of Las Vegas post-World War II. Anybody who watches the movies knows that organized crime had a foothold there. I'm so sure you probably saw the movie Bugsy about Siegel, et cetera. And there are clubs there. You know, Louis Armstrong makes quite a splash in Las Vegas. And, of course, he's oftentimes playing in clubs that are administered and owned by organized crime figures. So it's difficult to separate the trajectory of this music from a similar trajectory of organized crime.
And you write an enormous caveat in your book, and I'm quoting from your book: organized crime was not a vector of equal opportunity, but instead a hotbed of ethnic chauvinism. I mean, lest people think, well, wow, you know, they're making this deal with organized crime. At least they've got a gig. That's not the way it works out.
Well, yes. I mean, these musicians who are mostly black are considered worse than peons.
That's right.
They're the hired help, and they're treated quite shamelessly, oftentimes cheated out of money, cheated out of wages, et cetera. Oftentimes, I think I quote a story about Sonny Rollins. He brings his nice new overcoat to a club, and he leaves without that nice new overcoat because somehow it disappears. It's purloined. And so, you know, I mean, everybody knows, well, not since everybody knows, it's well known that organized crime families tend to be ethnically conceived. That is to say, the cliche is, of course, Italian-American, but of course there's Irish-American,
right.
There's Jewish-American, and then before the era of, after the era of Jim Crow, then you begin to see sort of black organized crime families arising as a counterpart.
Now, throughout your book, there always is a struggle for the artist to financially and artistically control their creative output. And that's one of the great struggles in this book. And I want to talk about that. Who are the first people? It seems like it's Mingus and Max Roach, maybe, who actually are among the first great artists to try to run their own companies.
Well, yes. I think that they're oftentimes given credit for being amongst the first, and I don't dispute that. But, of course, the times are changing. In the 1950s, with Brown versus Board of Education,
yep.
The U.S. Supreme Court decision in 1954, ruling Jim Crow to be no longer constitutional, and then that helps to create an atmosphere whereby Max and Mingus can develop debut records. But then, of course, they run into a stone wall of organized crime in terms of trying to get that business off the ground. And then there's just a structural problem because many of these musicians spend quite a bit of time practicing. I mean, John Coltrane, the saxophonist, is said to have practiced 15 to 16 hours a day sometimes. And Branford Marsalis, a fellow saxophonist, says that that's just too much, that, you know, that might have contributed to Coltrane's premature passing. So how are you going to run a music record business on the one hand and practice your instrument 15 to 16 hours a day? It's virtually impossible. It reminds me of what's oftentimes said about chess players, which is to be a grandmaster in chess, you have to be sort of incompetent in everything else because it's so jealous in terms of being a master of your time. And I think that that's the same is true for these musicians, that it's only so many hours in a day, and that if they're going to be masters of their instrument, then they're going to have to try to get someone else to handle the business and show business, and then that's when all the problems help or created or begin to be initiated.
Is Quincy Jones one of the first really tremendously successful black executives, as the term was used in your book? He seems to be one of the first great success stories.
Well, certainly he's in a class by himself.
Yeah.
In terms of being able to monetize, as they say in the United States, the music as a composer, as a horn man, as a band leader, as a executive, as a man who writes film scores. I mean, he's done quite well for himself. So certainly he's in a class by himself and has been celebrated globally.
I think, right.
One of the anecdotes that I end the book with is about him being honored in Italy, where he's wildly popular for his art. And at the same time, I talk about the young lions who are up and coming, such as Kamasi Washington
oh, yeah.
of Los Angeles, another horn man and band leader. Who just a few months ago played to a crowd of 5,000 in London, which I think helps to contradict this frequently and oft-cited idea that this music we call jazz is dying or dead.
Now, the 60s were a bad time, though, for jazz musicians. It was the Voting Rights Act passes, the Civil Rights Movement is happening, but for jazz musicians trying to play out, that was a tough time for jazz.
Well, of course, many of the musicians themselves were not that happy about the rise of the music we refer to as rock and roll. They felt that this helped to attract fans that otherwise would have been attracted to them. Some of them were rather sour about the development of this new art form. But I'm not so sure, because I think if you look at the broader landscape of this music, beyond looking at the top-flight musicians and the people you hear on certain radio stations, if you look at the proliferation of jazz orchestras in high schools and in colleges, for example, they are still proliferating. And if you look, I mentioned jazz at Lincoln Center. I could have mentioned the Thelonious Monk music competition in Washington, D.C., and, of course, the continuation of the popularity of this music in Europe and in Japan. I think that it might be a bit one-sided to just point the finger of accusation, as some musicians have done, at the rise of a competitive music form known as rock and roll.
Now, we just have a few minutes left. I want to talk about today jazz and the racial climate in America today, which seems like we've gone back decades. Is there, are artists today, like they were during the civil rights period? I think I'm thinking specifically of Max Roach, who is very involved in the civil rights movement, who wrote the Freedom Now suite. Are there jazz musicians now who are involved in the racial struggle?
Well, I don't think to the same extent that musicians were in the 1960s. You mentioned Max Roach, and of course there are others. Look at the compositions of Charles Mingus, for example.
Yeah.
Fables of Faubus, for example, about the Little Rock desegregation struggle of 1957, the Haitian fight song, for example. But I think that part of it is, once again, structural. I mean, there were mass movements in beginning of the late 1950s throughout the 1960s, propelled by changes in the law initiated by the U.S. Supreme Court, initiated by Congress, and that helped to propel people into the streets, which in turn helps to propel musicians. I think that to the extent musicians do not seem to be as involved in the 21st century in 2019 as they were some decades ago, well, then where are the mass movements of 2019? I mean, there are some, but they're not of the same magnitude as Martin Luther King's movement or the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, et cetera.
We're completely out of time. We could be talking about this book for years. My guest tonight is Gerald Horn. He is the John J. and Rebecca Morse Professor of African American History at the University of Houston. And we've been talking about his book, Jazz and Justice, Racism and the Political Economy of the Music. Gerald, it's been a real pleasure.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.